Welcome back to this deep dive, everyone. I'm your host, Nick Henley, and joined by my wife and my number one co-host, Sue. So, we are going to jump right back in from where we left off on our previous podcast episode. If you haven't listened to part one of this video series, please listen to it first. This is an involved story, and our previous episode, which is episode 57, named Fortress of Fraud, Inside the Southeast Asian Scam Farms, provides the backdrop of this real-life huge federal investigation out of the Southern District of California.
That's right, Nick. I know I am super excited to pick up where we left off, because it is so fascinating and compelling, yet so hard to comprehend. The level of human depravity and mistreatment is on a scale that is so hard to envision. Yet, what we are covering is derived from actual court and case files, so it is all too real. We've got a lot to cover today, Nick, so better jump back in now.
We really do, Sue. And before we pull back the first layer of this onion, we need to make something crystal clear for the listeners. Everything we are discussing today, the specific names, the logistics, the corporate fronts, it isn't just rumor or internet chatter.
No, it's not. And like I said, Nick, this is all too real.
Yes, unfortunately it is. And as I just mentioned, a large majority of this information is grounded in a massive, unsealed federal indictment out of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of California. We're also pulling from comprehensive threat assessments by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission and detailed FBI affidavits.
It's a staggering amount of evidence. It maps out a narrative that bleeds out of the digital shadows and into the physical world.
Exactly. So, just to recap for everyone, we're talking about modern 520-acre tech campuses. We're talking high-speed fiber optics running underground, manicured villas, state-of-the-art server farms, and massive, perfectly optimized logistical supply lines.
But then you take that Silicon Valley image, and you put heavily armed warlords at the front gates. You surround the entire perimeter with razor wire. And then you fill the inside of that complex with up to 100,000 trafficked souls.
People forced to sit behind keyboards for 18 hours a day. Welcome to Myanmar in the year 2026.
It honestly sounds like a Star Trek type of science fiction novel, but it is the actual physical reality shown through recent FBI and State Department investigation files. Which brings us to the question, how do these massive scam cities physically exist in plain sight?
Well, to answer that, we have to discard our Hollywood image of a criminal hideout.
Unpack that.
When we picture cyber criminals, most people think of some type of nerd or a kid who got bullied in school. But the syndicates running compounds like KK Park and Tai Chang, they may appear as tech nerds, but they are definitely not hiding in a basement or getting bullied. They are what we call state integrated.
State integrated. That is a terrifying phrase. Nick, put your federal agent hat on for a second. What is these guys?
These hubs are primarily in the Karen state of Myanmar, along the Moe River on the border with Thailand. The reason international law enforcement can't just launch a raid stems from a massive geopolitical power vacuum that basically tore the country apart.
You're talking about the military coup in 2021.
Exactly. The military junta overthrew the civilian government, triggering a nationwide civil war. The central authority suddenly found itself stretched thin.
Because they're fighting their own people. When a government is fighting for its survival, it pulls resources inward,
leaving the borders wide open.
Nature abhors a vacuum. Someone always steps into that void.
And in these border regions, that authority was seized by highly organized, heavily armed militias, ethnic armed organizations, or EAOs.
And these aren't just guys with hunting rifles. These are sophisticated military forces, like the Democratic Karen Benevolent Army, DKBA, and the Karen National Army, KNA.
So the local militias and border guards, they aren't just corrupt officers taking a bribe.
No, they are the actual landlords of the territory. Property managers and private security all rolled into one. It is an unholy, hyper-capitalist joint venture.
Warlords like Colonel Saw Chit Thu operate these territories like independent sovereign fiefs. But running a standing army requires an astronomical amount of capital.
Which is when the Chinese transnational criminal organizations arrive with briefcases full of cash.
The Chinese syndicates bring the capital and the cyber fraud tech. The EAOs bring the real estate and an impenetrable military shield.
They're literally protecting the servers.
FBI sources detail how soldiers wearing official DKBA uniforms are stationed at the gates of the Taichung Enterprise compound, armed with assault rifles.
But those rifles are facing inward just as much as outward. They aren't just guarding the syndicates. They are enforcing a closed slave labor ecosystem.
If a worker tries to run, they're dealing with a standing army. This is why Interpol or the US authorities cannot just show up. Entering that territory doesn't mean raiding a warehouse. It means initiating a ground war against a rebel army.
It's a geopolitical nightmare.
I was looking at the drone imagery analysis from the intelligence files earlier, and honestly, calling it a compound feels almost entirely inadequate. The infrastructure is staggering. We are talking about high-speed internet fiber lines routed directly into these remote jungles.
Yeah, the engineering logistics behind these facilities are fascinating and horrifying. The syndicates have basically designed these complexes to be entirely self-sufficient, autonomous city-states, right?
For example, in the Taichung compound, recent drone surveillance revealed these massive, newly constructed floating docks extending right into the Moe River.
Just floating up?
Yeah, and this allows the syndicates to bring in huge amounts of construction materials, food supplies, and server technology directly across the water from Thailand. They completely bypass any official land-based border checkpoints.
So, they have their own independent supply chain. But Sue, the neighboring countries aren't entirely passive, right? I read that Thailand actually attempted to sever the power grids and the internet fiber lines running across the border into these specific regions. Like, just physically starve the compounds of electricity and connectivity.
They did. But the resilience of these organizations is just terrifying. The moment the physical lines were cut by the Thai government, the syndicates adapted almost instantly. The drone footage we analyzed shows these distinct white rectangular squares strapped to the roofs of the concrete villas in Taichung and KK Park.
Wait, don't tell me. Satellite internet.
Satellite internet receivers. Smuggled Starlink terminals.
Exactly! Thai authorities have actually intercepted shipments of these terminals heading toward the border. By linking directly to low Earth orbit satellites, the scam operations bypass regional infrastructure entirely.
So they don't even need the physical cables anymore?
Not at all. The local power grid can go completely dark, and the syndicates just fire up their industrial diesel generators, connect directly to space, and keep defrauding victims without missing a single keystroke.
Okay, an autonomous, heavily armed criminal state with its own supply lines and satellite uplinks. It's almost hard to wrap your head around, but this brings up a massive, glaring geopolitical contradiction.
Okay, let's hear it.
The intelligence files consistently note that the syndicates running the capital and the technology are often Chinese-led transnational criminal organizations.
Right, they are.
Well, Beijing wields immense diplomatic, economic, and military influence over that entire region. It's their backyard. Why doesn't a superpower like China simply step in and crush them?
That is the million-dollar question. To understand why Beijing isn't just leveling these compounds with airstrikes, we have to look at the historical evolution of the syndicates. Years ago, the primary targets of these massive fraud factories were actually citizens of mainland China.
Oh, so they were scamming their own people originally.
Heavily. The wealth extraction was so severe that the Chinese government recognized it as a massive destabilizing economic threat. They began applying intense diplomatic pressure on Myanmar, and even directly on the border militias, demanding a total shutdown.
So there was an initial crackdown from the Chinese authorities.
There was a massive push. But you know, the syndicates are incredibly pragmatic. They analyzed the pressure points and realized they were only being hunted because they were draining Chinese wealth.
Right?
If they removed that specific pain point, the geopolitical heat would just vanish. And this realization triggered a terrifying operational pivot that the Chinese criminal underworld refers to as Xiangpan.
Which translates to what?
Foreigner butchering.
Foreigner butchering.
Yes, it is a direct, deliberate mutation of the original pig butchering scam model. The syndicates shifted their entire massive infrastructure, the servers, the scripts, the tens of thousands of trafficked laborers, to exclusively target Westerners, Americans, Europeans, Australians.
And the authorities just stopped caring.
There's actually a chilling visual representation of this. In the sources, China's Ministry of Public Security released a viral video back in 2021. It showed the results of one of those early border crackdowns.
What's in the video?
It shows dozens of young Chinese men, all arrested for online fraud in Myanmar, standing in a formation. They are chanting a mandated confession in unison. They say, "We conducted scams in northern Burma. Now we have returned to the motherland's embrace. We are Chinese. Chinese don't scam Chinese."
Chinese don't scam Chinese. That is wild. It frames the crime not as a moral failing of committing fraud, but as a failure of targeting the wrong nationality. It's like this twisted patriotic motto.
That is exactly how they view it. The syndicates internalize that exact justification. As long as the wealth they're extracting is coming out of the United States and Europe, the local regimes and Chinese authorities largely view it as somebody else's problem.
So they just turn a blind eye?
Pretty much. A Chinese lawyer who frequently works on these international fraud cases actually noted a really disturbing psychological trend among the perpetrators. Many of them genuinely believe that defrauding foreigners isn't a real crime. They view it as a form of patriotic economic warfare.
Which, if you think about it, places a massive, entirely unprotected target squarely on the back of you, the listener.
Exactly.
The global geopolitical architecture has essentially deemed Western citizens as acceptable collateral damage in this shadow economy. As long as the fraud goes west, the warlords get to keep their casinos.
And the success of this impunity model means it is highly contagious. The sources detail how this foreigner targeting blueprint has spread far beyond the jungles of Southeast Asia.
Right. We saw this vividly with the recent massive raid in Lagos, Nigeria. Yeah, the Lagos raid was a huge wake-up call. Nigerian law enforcement raided a 7-story fortified scam compound right in the middle of the city. They arrested over 140 Chinese nationals.
In Nigeria?
In Nigeria. And those nationals weren't just running the scams themselves. They had recruited and trained hundreds of local Nigerians to execute the exact same psychological manipulation scripts, specifically targeting victims in North America.
So, it's spreading.
The model of state-shielded industrialized fraud targeting Westerners has literally become a franchisable export.
Well, if warlords and geopolitical loopholes provide the physical shield for the servers, the next logical step in any forensic investigation is to follow the money.
Always follow the money.
And the sheer volume of wealth we are talking about here is difficult to conceptualize. Blockchain analytics firms estimate that in 2025 alone, there were $158 billion in total illicit cryptocurrency flows.
A staggering number.
And out of that, roughly $17 billion was directly tied to fraud and scams. Let me just repeat that. $17 billion completely drained from the life savings of everyday people.
So I want to trace the mechanical reality of how $17 billion simply vanishes. I mean, the fundamental premise of a blockchain is that it is a permanent, immutable public ledger. Every single transaction is recorded for the entire world to see forever.
True.
So how do these syndicates hide money in plain sight on a public database? Break this down for us.
The syndicates have engineered a multi-layered pipeline specifically designed to overwhelm human investigators and basically shatter the chain of custody. The blockchain is indeed public, but it is pseudonymous.
Right. It doesn't have your name attached.
Exactly. It doesn't record names or social security numbers. It only records long strings of alphanumeric characters. Let's trace the flow of a hypothetical victim's funds to see the mechanics in action.
Okay, let's use one of the specific seized domains from the case files we have. Say a victim transfers $50,000 in Bitcoin to what they genuinely believe is a legitimate, high investment platform called Tikmelis.com.
Okay.
The victim hits send on their phone. What is happening right at that second on the syndicate's end?
The instant the blockchain confirms the funds have arrived at the syndicate's receiving wallet, automated scripts trigger. Human hands do not touch this money yet.
It's all code.
All code. The funds are immediately fired into the first layer of digital obfuscation. We call this a network of hop wallets.
Hop wallets. Break down the function of a hop wallet.
Think of a hop wallet as a digital burner phone. It exists for mere seconds, maybe minutes. Its singular purpose is to receive a deposit and instantly forward it to another destination. So, it functions like a getaway car tearing through a city, taking 100 random turns down dark alleys to lose a tail.
That's a great analogy. But imagine a getaway car that splits into a dozen different cars at every single intersection.
Wow. Sounds like a Transformer movie, doesn't it?
It does. So, Nick, the automated software takes that initial $50,000 and fractures it into hundreds of smaller, randomized amounts. It bounces those fractions through thousands of temporary burner addresses. The goal is to generate an overwhelming volume of transactional noise.
Just bury the signal.
Right? When an investigator pulls up the public ledger, they don't see a straight line from point A to point B. They see a massive, chaotic web of meaningless microtransfers.
But software leaves a trail, right? And law enforcement utilizes incredibly sophisticated tracking software. Now, the ledger is permanent. So, technically, the FBI could eventually map out all those hop wallets and reconstruct the original $50,000, can't they?
Yes. Given enough computing power and time, law enforcement can absolutely untangle the web of hop wallets.
Okay.
But the syndicates know this. The hop wallets only exist to buy them time. To permanently sever the mathematical link between the victim and the stolen funds, the syndicates push the fractured cryptocurrency into the black boxes of digital money laundering, crypto mixers.
Okay, stop right there, because this is where the technology usually loses people. Crypto mixer sounds like a generic term, but the underlying mathematics are incredibly complex.
Explain the mechanics of a mixer, specifically how it uses concepts like zero-knowledge proofs. If I am throwing my dirty Bitcoin into this system, how does it process it without recording my identity?
So, a crypto mixer operates on decentralized smart contracts. You can visualize it as a massive cryptographic blender. Criminals from all over the world deposit their stolen cryptocurrency into the central pool. But simultaneously, legitimate users who simply want financial privacy for their legal transactions also deposit their funds into the exact same pool.
Wait, so dirty money and clean money are literally sloshing around in the same digital vault?
Exactly. The smart contract then takes all of that pooled cryptocurrency and shreds it into microscopic fractional pieces. It shuffles those pieces continuously. Regarding zero-knowledge proofs, this is a cryptographic method where one party can prove to another that a statement is true without revealing any information beyond the absolute validity of the statement itself.
Give me a real-world example for that. That's hard to grasp.
Okay, imagine you need to prove to a bouncer at a club that you are over 21, but you don't want the bouncer to know your name, your address, or your exact birth date. A zero-knowledge proof allows the system to verify mathematically that yes, you possess the required authorization, without ever linking your identity to the transaction.
So the bouncer knows I am of age, but knows literally nothing else about me.
Precisely. The mixer uses this logic to spit the shuffled fractional pieces of cryptocurrency back out to brand new, entirely unconnected wallet addresses at completely randomized time intervals.
Which means the specific $50,000 I deposited is chopped into digital dust, mixed with the dust of 10,000 other people, and then reformed into a new $50,000 on the other side.
Yes. The public ledger will clearly show that money went into the mixer and that money came out of the mixer, but it mathematically severs the chain of custody. It becomes statistically impossible for an investigator to prove in a court of law that the specific Bitcoin emerging belongs to the specific victim. It is a virtual money laundering machine, which, if you think about it, it's absolutely frightening.
It is frightening. Because in your day investigating money laundering cases, you had physical documents or financial records to track. But in this day and age of cryptocurrency, that trail is just gone, or at least much more difficult to track.
You're absolutely right, Sue. Now the trail is completely, mathematically, dead.
The posting specifically demanded candidates who could mimic American speech patterns and who were willing to work the graveyard shift in Southeast Asia, which, if you do the math, perfectly aligns with daytime business hours in the United States.
What was the specific operational goal requiring an American accent? Like, why go to that length?
They were recruiting for a highly specialized, elaborate law enforcement and banking impersonation scheme. The syndicates would force the trafficked workers to cold call American targets, posing as customer service representatives from institutions like JP Morgan Chase.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I recall reading that in the court documents. That's absolutely amazing.
It is. The worker would inform the victim that their bank account had been severely compromised and used to facilitate illegal firearms purchases.
Just immediately instilling terror. And once the victim is sufficiently panicked, the trap closes.
Exactly. The fake bank representative would then generously offer to transfer the victim to a federal investigator to help clear things up. The call is then routed to another trafficked worker sitting in the exact same room who has been specifically trained to perfectly impersonate an NYPD detective or an FBI agent, complete with the American accent and fabricated badge numbers.
It is pure psychological warfare. They are literally weaponizing the victim's inherent, ingrained trust in structural institutions against them. By seizing that pogo telegram channel, the FBI cut off a vital supply line of the specialized labor required to run that specific manipulation.
But as effective as the physical arrests and the digital seizures are, the true measure of a syndicate's operational power is its capital reserve. To neutralize the threat, law enforcement has to starve the beast.
And this leads to the single most consequential victory detailed in the court files: the Justice Department's indictment of Chen Zi, the billionaire chairman of the Prince Group in Cambodia.
But they didn't just file criminal charges. They executed a staggering financial blow. They seized $15 billion in Bitcoin.
$15 billion? It stands as the largest financial forfeiture action in the history of the United States. Now, Sue, during my law enforcement career, I seized bank accounts, cars, homes, and various other assets. Now, these assets were all tied to an illegal activity, so don't weep for the people who lost their assets. These were drug dealers, high-tech theft rings, and various other illegal activities. But I can tell you this, I never seized anything close to $15 billion.
It's a different world, isn't it? So, Nick, we need to pause here and look at the technical reality of all this, because it sounds impossible. I mean, the entire foundational premise of cryptocurrency is decentralization. There is no central bank to subpoena. There is no CEO of Bitcoin who can freeze an account.
Right.
If Chen Zi controls the private cryptographic keys to that wallet, and he is sitting in a mansion in Cambodia outside of U.S. jurisdiction, how does the United States government physically seize $15 billion on a decentralized blockchain?
Great question. It is a brilliant use of protocol-level intervention. You are absolutely correct that law enforcement cannot simply kick down a server door and carry out boxes of Bitcoin. They cannot guess the private keys. Instead, they freeze the funds in digital amber by targeting the centralized choke points within the decentralized ecosystem.
Ah, the stablecoin issuers and the centralized exchanges.
Precisely. The blockchain analytics firms working with the FBI, firms like Chainalysis, trace the stolen funds through the Hop wallets and mixers until they identify the massive consolidation wallets controlled by the Prince Group. Law enforcement then serves court orders directly to the companies that issue centralized stablecoins, such as Tether and Circle.
Because the syndicates use those to peg their volatile crypto to the US dollar to protect their profits.
Exactly. So the syndicate still holds the password to the vault.
But the network itself welds the vault door shut.
The stablecoin issuers possess the protocol-level authority to blacklist specific wallet addresses across the entire global network. The moment Chen Zi or his lieutenants attempt to initiate a transfer, the network architecture simply rejects the transaction.
Wow. The funds are entirely immobilized.
They are trapped on the public ledger, completely visible to the syndicate, but entirely inaccessible, pending final legal forfeiture. It is a monumental achievement in financial disruption.
It is a historic victory, but Nick, it brings us to a devastating realization. Seizing $15 billion after the crime provides justice, sure, but it means the victims' lives have already been shattered.
The retirement accounts are empty. The second mortgages have been signed. The funds are gone.
How does law enforcement stop the devastation from occurring in the first place?
The FBI field office in San Diego recognized that exact failure in the traditional model. Their response was a radical tactical shift called Operation Level Up.
This initiative represents the most innovative paradigm shift in the entire global counteroffensive.
Because the traditional model is inherently reactive. A crime happens, a victim files a report, and an investigation begins months after the trail has gone cold. In the realm of crypto, if you wait for the victim to complain, the money is already through the mixer and sitting in a Cambodian casino.
Exactly. So Operation Level Up completely inverted that model.
They moved from a reactive posture to a proactive, offensive posture. The FBI San Diego field office partnered with elite private blockchain analytics firms to monitor the public ledger in real time. They are actively scanning for the specific digital signatures of an ongoing scam.
So the case files indicated that they use a technique called heuristic analysis. Break down how that works in practice.
Heuristic analysis involves training highly sophisticated algorithms to recognize the behavioral patterns of fraud. The algorithms aren't looking for names, they are looking for specific transactional shapes. They monitor the blockchain for the sudden emergence of those massive consolidation wallets we discussed, combined with the rapid, chaotic firing of hop wallets.
Looking for the noise.
Right. When the algorithm detects that specific pattern, it flags it as a pig butchering scam currently in progress.
Okay, so the algorithm identifies the syndicate's receiving wallet. But how do they find the victim?
They trace the money backward. Once the analysis identifies the destination, the investigators reverse engineer the getaway route. They unspool the thread until they locate the initial deposit point, which is almost always a legitimate US-based cryptocurrency exchange like Coinbase or Kraken.
Right, the place where the victim first converted their life savings into Bitcoin.
Exactly. And then the FBI immediately serves a rapid response subpoena to that US exchange. The exchange complies, providing the KYC, know your customer, data. This reveals the true identity and contact information of the account holder.
So they identify the victim mid-scam while the fraud is actively taking place.
The agents are literally intervening while the victim is sitting on their couch, holding their phone, firmly believing they are communicating with a wealthy romantic partner or a trusted, brilliant investment guru.
The psychological shock of receiving that phone call is just difficult to fathom. You believe you are weeks away from retiring a millionaire, building a life with someone who understands you perfectly. And instead, your phone rings and an FBI agent informs you that the person you've been texting every single night for 6 months is a trafficked slave chained to a desk in a Burmese jungle. And the money you just wired is currently funding a warlord.
It completely shatters the fabricated reality the victim has been living in. The emotional devastation of having that illusion broken so violently is profound. The sources actually note that the FBI agents conducting Operation Level Up have frequently had to refer the victims they contact directly to suicide intervention specialists.
My God, this is truly the dark side results of these scams that we cover here at Behind the Scams.
It is! For these victims, the sudden realization of both the financial ruin and the deep emotional betrayal is more than many people can process at once.
But the intervention protocol is working. The financial metrics tied to Operation Level Up are staggering.
By identifying the transactional patterns and intervening before the victim can authorize that final catastrophic wire transfer, the one that drains the 401k or liquidates the home equity, the FBI has successfully notified nearly 9,000 active victims.
And the total amount of wealth preserved?
An estimated $562 million. Over $500 million of American wealth saved from the syndicates simply by outpacing the scammers and breaking the psychological spell before the trap fully closes.
Which brings this massive geopolitical narrative directly into the living room of the listener. The FBI is executing global raids in Dubai. They are freezing $15 billion in stablecoins. They are utilizing heuristic algorithms to hack the blockchain. But as powerful as Operation Level Up is, the Bureau cannot monitor every single smartphone in the United States.
No, they can't. They cannot sit next to you on the couch when a random, seemingly innocent text message from a wrong number pops up on your screen.
Law enforcement, the State Department, and the tech firms are winning significant tactical battles. They are shutting down fraudulent domains and intercepting management-level enforcers. But the ultimate war, the war for your financial survival, will only be won on the front lines of what we call psychological hygiene.
Psychological hygiene. Yeah, we need to dissect that concept before we wrap up, because this is the foundational everyday survival takeaway for anyone interacting with the digital world.
We spend billions of dollars building technical firewalls, biometric security, and encrypted networks. But a technical firewall is entirely useless if the human being holding the cryptographic keys is socially engineered to simply open the door and hand the keys over.
Right? These syndicates employ world-class psychological manipulation. They prey on universal human vulnerabilities, loneliness, ambition for wealth, the fear of missing out. But their ultimate weapon, the mechanism they rely on to finalize the theft and escape, is the victim's own shame.
The weaponization of shame. How does that protect the syndicate?
When the illusion finally breaks, when the victim realizes the investment dashboard is a programmed fake and the romantic partner is a phantom, the immediate, overwhelming human reaction is profound embarrassment. You feel utterly foolish. The syndicates count on the absolute certainty that you will be too ashamed to admit to your spouse, your children, or to law enforcement that you have been deceived.
They weaponize your pride to buy themselves the one thing they need most: time. Time to run the stolen crypto through the mixers before anyone alerts the authorities.
Silence is the frictionless grease that allows the money laundering pipeline to operate at maximum efficiency. Therefore, the defensive directive for anyone listening is twofold. First, you must implement a policy of extreme verification. If you receive an urgent request involving money, even if the caller ID says it's your bank or a trusted family member, you must verify that request out of band.
Out of band verification, meaning if I receive a terrifying phone call from someone claiming to be a JP Morgan fraud investigator saying my account is being drained, I don't engage. I just hang up the phone.
You hang up immediately. You do not trust the incoming channel, no matter how convincing the American accent is. You locate the official verified customer service number printed on the back of your physical debit card, and you initiate a brand new outbound call yourself. You reestablish the connection on your own terms.
And the second directive, the one that determines whether the money is lost forever or potentially recovered?
If you suspect, even for a fraction of a second, that you are being targeted, or worse, that you have already transferred funds, you must bypass the shame immediately. You have to swallow your pride, endure the embarrassment, and report the exact granular details of the transaction immediately to the FBI at ic3.gov, the Internet Crime Complaint Center.
Do not wait 24 hours to see if the investment dashboard comes back online. Do not attempt to negotiate a withdrawal fee with the scammer. Go straight to ic3.gov.
We just mapped out exactly how Operation Level Up functions. The FBI has the tools to trace these funds, but cold, hard mathematics dictates that early, rapid reporting provides the only statistical chance of freezing your stolen assets before they disappear into the mixers. In this ecosystem, speed is the only known antidote.
Speed and reporting. It is a perpetual escalating game of cat and mouse on a global scale. As we conclude this deep dive, there is a final sobering reality to mull over.
We've analyzed the warlords, the billionaire senators, and the zero-knowledge proofs. But the truly terrifying aspect is the sheer biological resilience of organized crime.
They really do operate like a highly adaptive, mutating organism.
Exactly. When the Chinese government cracked down, they adapted by mutating their targeting into Xiangpan, butchering foreigners. When authorities seize domains, they launch 50 new ones in minutes. When Thailand severs their power, they pivot to satellites. The moment the international community engineers a taller wall, the syndicates engineer a taller ladder.
The tools will only get faster. The deep fakes will only get more convincing. And the psychological manipulation will only become more sophisticated.
Which means that no algorithm, no strike force, and no firewall can completely protect you. The only true, impenetrable defense is an educated, resilient, and fiercely skeptical mind.
That's right. This isn't just about protecting your bank account. It's about protecting your reality.
We're going to keep digging into these types of federal case files and bringing you the truth from the front lines. If you found this series helpful, please share it with a friend. You might just be the out-of-band verification they need. And Sue, before we close, I just want to give a shout out to all my fellow brothers and sisters in federal and state law enforcement. They are doing a fantastic job of keeping up with these scammers and holding them accountable for their crimes.
Great point, Nick. They often serve as unsung heroes. We certainly applaud their efforts here and behind the scams and stamp out scams, otherwise known as the SOS Media Network. So on that great note, this is Sue saying bye for now. Until next time, stay safe and stay scam free.
And I'm Nick Henley. We'll see you on the next episode of Behind the Scams. Stay skeptical out there.